I want to start with a little comparison with what's different and what's the same between Ginzburg-Lander vortices and atoms. So quantum chemistry, what I'm going to talk about, is a model for atoms and their interactions. And so let's start with what's the same. So both these guys interact by a field equation. Ignore this remark for the moment. So the main thing that makes quantum chemistry easier than Ginzburg-Landau is that the field equation is linear. But there's a price to pay, because the space dimension of the field equation increases with the number of atoms. So if you add more and more atoms, the equation goes into higher and higher dimensions. And in some sense, this linearity is somewhat deceptive. So if you project the equation back into R3, where the atoms move, it becomes nonlinear and nonlocal. So one has to be a bit careful with this. Now in GL, okay, you have a nonlinear equation, but the space dimension stays the same if you put more and more vortices. And then there's another difference that I sort of want to point out in connection with Sylvia Serfati's talk yesterday in particular. So in the GL case, the leading order interaction term between two vortices comes from the fact that when you move one of the vortices, or when then the far field rearranges, but the local profile at the vortex sort of stays the same. So it turns out in quantum chemistry, it's exactly the other way around. So when you bring another atom in the vicinity of an atom that was already there, what changes is not the far field. So nothing happens in the middle in between these two objects, but instead the presence of the second atom causes the first atom to change its local structure. So if you want, this is a sort of action at a distance, and this effect is sort of, it's not a good idea to try and understand it by saying, oh, the equation is local and linear, because that's deceptive, because you went into a higher dimensional space. And somehow when you project into back into R3, this becomes quite clearly understood, because then the equation becomes nonlinear and non-local, and it's the non-locality when you project back in the lower dimension that can give this action at a distance. So that's sort of my brief introduction. So now I hope I got you curious what the field equation is, in case you haven't seen it. So here's the field equation of quantum chemistry. So it looks a bit horrible at first, but it really has a lot of structure. So maybe do we have a pointer? Okay. I try to sort of grow up a bit. And so oh, thanks. So I would have had that. Why didn't I have the idea to use that? Ah, these local guys. There are two main problems one wants to understand in quantum chemistry. One is if atoms consist of heavy atomic nuclei, which are usually modeled classically, so quantum fluctuations of these are ignored, because they're much smaller in length scale than the quantum fluctuations of the electrons by a factor of about 1,000. And then you have electrons moving around these nuclei. So if you fix the positions of the nuclei and you know which type of atom there are, so you know which charges, so they come in charges 1, then you have a hydrogen atom, 2, you have a helium atom, 3, lithium, and so on. And you know how many electrons are in your system, so usually the number of electrons in a neutral system would just be you add up all the nuclear charges in the system, and then you have a neutral system of atoms. And then you minimize some energy, which depends on a wave function, on an electronic state function, which is a function from R to the 3n into C to the 2 to the n. So let's ignore the C to the 2 to the n for the moment. Focus on the R to the n, so the wave function depends on all the positions of all the electrons, and those are numbers in R3, and you have n electrons, so that that gives you, that brings you into R to the 3n. And then the energy you minimize is kind of very simple. So basically you have a kinetic energy term, and connecting with Fabrice Bettuel's talk. So I think I want to talk about the half in front of the gradient, if you allow me 10 seconds. So this factor a half, it doesn't really come from physicists. It sort of comes from God, or if you don't believe in God, it comes from Schrödinger's brain, whoever injected it into there, in the following form. So the constant really, if you want those constants in front of the electrostatic terms, then the constant you get there is something like a half is really h bar squared over 2me squared at h bar equals e equals m equals 1, where h bar is Planck's constant, m is the mass of the electron, and e is the charge of the electron. So somehow you can't get rid of this a half unless you redefine h bar, but I mean that comes from spectroscopic experiments, so you kind of shouldn't. So in atomic units you use these units, and then these terms have ratio 1. So now we have kinetic energy, which is a quantum term, with the h bar in front, and then the electrons attract the nuclei, and so the psi modulus squared is just the probability distribution of all the positions of all the xi's. So psi is really a function of x1, xn, and so and if you mod square this, this gives you the probability distribution. So you just integrate take the expected value of electron nuclear attraction, given that the electrons are in this state, the expected value of electron repulsion, they're all Coulombic, and the expected value of nuclear repulsion. So basically everybody attracts or repels everybody else Coulombically, with the signs depending on whether you have a like charge or unlike charge. So that's it. And now the sort of then the second problem you really want to understand, where I would say which would be of a lot of interest, especially for sort of applied subjects like chemistry, material science, and so on, is to understand better the interatomic potential you get. I mean, it's sort of easy to prove it exists, but what does it do? And so that's just defined by taking the minimum energy of the molecule, so you minimize over electronic states and subtract out the energy of the individual atoms, which means you sum over all the atoms and minimize just the problem for that atom. And so so before I go to admissible class of psi's here, want to explain this, but I want to first say a little bit about problem two. So one of the interesting things there is that it has a kind of really spectacular dependence on the type of atom you use, even though there was no symmetry breaking somehow in the energy I wrote here. And for instance, if you look at dimers, so just take two atoms and you ask, okay, you indirectly compute this interatom. So you suppose you had computed it, and then some quantity you can measure experimentally easily, for instance the binding energy, which is the depth of this dip here. And here's an experimental plot of this as a function of atomic number. So I'm measuring this dip for different kinds of atoms. So here is H2 plus, H2, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon. And so this sort of plots are not easy to understand. And in some sense, I would say that much of the mathematical work in... Oh, that's a question. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, sure. I mean, I said I postponed the admissible class. Yeah, so this is the correct... But this is not numerical analysis. I mean, you can't simply compute them numerically because of the space dimension. Maybe I have time to explain why. It's a very high dimension problem. So anyway, my point I want to make here is that there are huge differences between these different systems, and a lot of the mathematical work was sort of rather what I would call mathematical physics as opposed to quantum chemistry, where you typically look at universal properties of these sort of systems. Yeah, I mean, it's an oversimplification. There have been some physicists who've been interested in chemistry questions and vice versa, but much less is known about non-universal pictures like this. So even an approximate mathematical explanation of this plot and the kind of number theory that favors, like, 20 electrons and 8 and so on, is really not known. So, I have a little bit to say. So one of the things I want to present here is sort of the first rigorous result that I think that we have, which is sort of atom specific and relates to the structure of this potential. Get to that in the end. Leave the energy there. I didn't say what the admissible class of trial functions was. Now let's go back to problem one. I want to talk about some basic theory for problem one. Admissible class, okay, so due to the gradient here, you go into the finite energy space, and these Coulomb singularities, they're kind of not bad because they only appear in one coordinate at a time, so somehow it's like being in R3, and sort of H1 embeds into L6 in R3, so if you square, you're in L3, so you would be allowed a potential in kind of L3 halves, but 1 over Coulomb is almost in L3. So the singularity is really safe. So there's no problem with sort of, boundness from below and so on. So H1 is a good space on which this guy is continuous. Then you want the L2 norm to be 1. That's simply saying the total probability that all the electrons are somewhere is 1. And then there's a sort of anti-symmetry condition. Electrons are fermions, so their wave functions have to be anti-symmetric under simultaneous exchange of state and spin. So if you write the wave function psi, I said it takes values in c to the 2 to the n, because it has 2 to the n spin components, such as psi plus 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 plus, where all the spins are spin up, or psi minor, where all the spins are spin down, and they're 2 to the n combinations. So you have 2 to the n components. And if you simultaneously exchange space and spin coordinates, the wave function gets a minus sign. So that's this Pauli condition. And there, sort of, what you do in quantum chemistry is also you really want to approximate this sort of set here based on statistical independence assumptions or partial statistical independence assumptions, and the one of the standard, I give you some standard models. So one of them is called Hartree-Fock theory. So assume for simplicity, because I don't want to write these spin components, that all spins are aligned. So you have a function from R3n into C. You just assume that that the wave function is a Slater determinant. That means, should maybe write this down, what a Slater determinant is. It's a special kind of wave function. So phi 1, phi n, n. So this gives you a function on r to the 3n, which is anti-symmetric. If you take 1 over square root n factorial, and you take the determinant of the following m by n matrix, phi 1 of x1 dot dot dot, phi 1 of xn, phi n of x1, phi n of xn. Okay, and that's then anti-symmetric, and so it's a sort of special class of trial functions. And so the reason why you want to do that is not really because you believe in statistical independence, but because you're sort of desperate to simplify the kinematics. So it's sort of, if you do numerics, so then let's say this R3, you discretize it into, say, let's say L grid points. Yeah. So you go into L grid points, and when you look at the function, at the dimension of the space of size, which go from A1, AL to the N into C, so then you just get L to the N. And if you do this Hartree-Fock model, so you give you give one wave function to each electron. So it's a huge difference. So if you take sort of these phi ones and phi n's, which go from A1 AL into C, so this is just n times L. So basically this problem has no numerical difficulty. This has, I mean, if you have an H2O molecule, you have n is equal to 10, and you can sort of, with luck, do a diagonalize a 10 by 10 matrix. So your Schrödinger equation is an eigenvalue equation for 10, if L is 10 and N is 10, for 10 to the 10 times 10 to the 10 matrix. So that's about the limit you can do numerically with luck. So on the other hand, there's no reason why electrons want to be statistically independent. So there's also a sort of exactification of this model, where you say, well, maybe asking that there are only n wave functions and the electrons must choose which one they go into is a bit rich. You should sort of give them more choice and offer more orbitals than you have electrons. And so the right way quantum mechanically to write that down is you somehow offer k functions on R3, where k is bigger than n, and you look at linear combinations of all Slater determinants you can build from these. And so somehow you get L partial differential equations as Euler-Lagrange equations and so on. But of course, the fact that you have coefficients in front of these Slater determinants here again sort of brings up the complexity quickly. So you sort of have to trade off. Formally, if you let k go to infinity, no, actually rigorously, it's trivial to see that you approach the exact energy. It's just because these sort of sets are dense asymptotically in the whole space. So okay, so why I didn't explain why Hartree-Fock means statistical independence up to antisymmetry. Okay, that's very simple. So a nicer way, which is less elementary, but the right way of writing this is you really make the ansatz that the wave function is a product, which means statistical independence, because then the probability distribution just factors. But you have to respect this anti-symmetry principle, so therefore you project this guy onto the subspace of L2 of anti-symmetric functions. And it's a sort of easy fact that such a guy can never be anti-symmetric unless he's zero. But at the same time, the projection onto the anti-symmetric subspace, if these guys are normalized, is never zero unless this guy was zero. It just changes by a normalization factor. So that's how one could think of these. Sort of better way of thinking of this Hartree-Fock. Now, what's known about these various models? So just briefly review. So I think existence is now well understood because enough people went over it somehow. So for quantum mechanics, now let's look at existence theory. If you want, this is sort of the warm-up. So for simplicity, I just discussed quantum mechanics. So the existence theory for quantum mechanics was done in the 1960 in Russian. So if you want, this is about 35 years after the equation was written down. So it took people a long time. And for Hartree Fock, it was done in the late 70s using weak convergence methods. And for the multi-configuration, for this mixed models, it's a sort of recent result. But I would say my principal achievement is sort of simplifying this proof here rather than treating these other models. So, so a bit of notation. The infimum over these wave functions, I call it capital E of N. And there's also another quantity that enters, which I call E0 of N, which is the infimum of the functional without the electron nuclei attraction. So I kill this attraction term. Actually, this E0 is actually zero in our case. But I like to write zero like this, because somehow if you had different pair interactions, for instance, which wouldn't be completely repulsive but partially attractive, for instance, if you want to discuss Bose-Einstein condensation or systems like that, then these numbers wouldn't be zero. So the theory would be the same. And there's also a nice auxiliary quantity. You can ask, so this wave function in R to the 3n is hard to imagine or visualize. I mean, I always have difficulty visualizing it. So it's nice to think of the honest electron density in honest R3. So I simply ask, what's the expected number of electrons, density of electrons at some point x? You compute it by taking this wave function squared and put a Dirac here where you check whether the ith electron is at point x. And then you check for all electrons, means you sum, and that gives you this quantity. So this is a good one to look at. So it would concentrate presumably near the atomic nuclei and then sort of fall off. Results that one then has for these models. So the first result is sort of that if you look at a general minimizing sequence, maybe this formula needs to be read from the right, not the left. So let's start here. So you compute, so you take a ball of radius r and you check how many electrons are outside. Then you do that for a sufficiently low energy state. So you let the minimizing sequence index go to zero. So this gives you the expected number of electrons outside the ball of radius r, and then you take the limit of radius goes to infinity, and if you do the limit in this order, what you get is simply the expected number of electrons which escape to infinity. And sort of physics tells you this sort of should be an integer, but mathematically it's not clear from writing this integral there. I just wrote an integral over some function, this guy is actually an integer, and there's the compactness criterion. Each minimizing sequence is compact in H1, strongly if and only if you have some sub-additivity inequalities. I get to that in a minute. And minimizers exist provided you have enough nuclear charge to bind these electrons. So, for instance, in the neutral case, which is the standard case, you always get existence. That's no problem. And there are examples of non-attainment when you get greedy and try to bind too many electrons. So the classical example is by Elliot Lieb in 1985. So for H-, so a hydrogen atom with two more electrons, and turns out that two electrons can stay near the nucleus and fight for the nucleus, and the third guy sort of runs off to infinity. So asymptotically, this charge density for a minimizing sequence would sort of look like this. So just a short comment on this compactness criterion. So it's a bit different from the usual concentration compactness, because the list of inequalities you're checking here is quantized. And so it's not continuous in some parameter. And second, it compares problems on domains of different spatial dimension. Yeah? So a d electron system lives on r to the 3d, and n minus d lives on r to the 3n minus d. So it's a little bit different, not with different value of the constraint. And if you want, the reason for that is sort of algebraic. It's sort of a general point about quantum mechanics, that there are too many, I mean, every Tom, Dick, and Harry can add two wave functions, but that's not such an interesting thing to do. It's much more interesting to add and subtract particles. And if you want, this means that, so these sets of wave functions, they should be considered as an algebra indexed by the number of particles, and then you have maps that go from an to an plus 1 and so on, called creation operators, and the other way around called annihilation operators, and it's somehow this algebra structure with respect to which the splitting somehow occurs. Okay, but I mean, I'm not saying this is very deep, but this is sort of the right way of looking at what's happening here. So it's really this algebra structure, not so things don't split into sums, but into tensor products. Now, a quick sketch of proof of sufficiency. It's sort of by soft, suppose you had a non-compact sequence. By soft argument, some charge must escape to infinity. And then you find that the value of the limiting energy, okay, it depends on the escape direction in r to the 3n. And for instance, if you have a sequence where electrons x1 to xd want to go off to infinity, and the rest want to stay bound, but would mean in this many-body picture that the support of the wave function would be living somewhere here. So it moves off to infinity in some direction, stays bound in another direction, and then asymptotically you can drop certain terms in the energy, like then these guys are far away from these guys because you're far away from the diagonal, so you drop the right kind of terms, and the energy asymptotically, it should be like a energy of d free electrons and n minus d bound ones, and sort of so in fancier language, it's somehow enough to do a 2 to the n point compactification of r to the 3n, because all you need to know is sort of which electrons stay bound and which go to infinity, and there are 2 to the n possibilities, and so that sort of takes care of this. So I think I wanted to talk a little bit about now what one would like to understand next is a little bit about the structure of these minimizers and how good these truncation approximations are. I mean, how good is it to just assume the wave function was Hartree-Fock? Okay, it's clear that in the variational principle we have no right to postulate this a priori, but maybe the true minimizers for a typical problem could be quite close to Hartree-Fock, to a Slater determinant. Yeah? So how do we know? And so there's a way of measuring, I mean, there's a sort of better formulation of these variational principles, which goes by a nice operator introduced by Dirac, Paul Dirac, that is. And it's sort of like an autocorrelation function related to the Wigner transform. So you take just bear with me. I just tell you what he defines. So if you take the wave function, translate it in one coordinate, integrate out the rest, that gives you a function of x and x prime in r to the 6. Now that you interpret as an integral kernel of an operator. So you it acts on some function phi in L2 by integrating out over the x prime. So that gives you an operator. And then it turns out you can tell by looking at this operator here whether or not your original wave function was Slater or not, or by how much it deviates. It's sort of the right way of measuring the distance from Slater. So the theorem is that this rank of this guy is equal to n if and only if psi was Slater, and it's less or equal k if and only if it was one of these multi-configuration wave functions. And so if you want, then a cleaner formulation of these various variational principles would be you minimize this always the same functional subject to normalization, anti-symmetry, and then you put a condition on this rank. And if you make k equals n, you get Hartree-Fock. If you make it infinite, you have no constraint, you get quantum mechanics. If you crank it up in between, you get these mixed models. And so somehow then the beauty of this is you can sort of look at somehow, you can now draw a picture somehow, what's the difference between a Hartree-Fock wave function and a and a sort of non-Hartree-Fock one by looking at the eigenvalues of this autocorrelation operator. So now this density matrix happens to be a compact self-adjoint operator, and as it's less easy to see, it's bounded above by the identity, so the eigenvalues have to be less than 1. That comes from the fact that the psi was anti-symmetric. If you want, that's a beautiful way of seeing the Pauli principle. And the trace of this guy has to be equal to n, which is the number of particles in the system. So that tells you that these eigenfunctions are always between 0 and 1 and have to sum to n. And then, okay, to visualize this constraint here, look at the spectrum. So quantum mechanics says these eigenvalues can be anything they like as long as they're between 0 and 1. Hartree-Fock says they must be the first n guys must be 1, the others must be 0. And multi-configuration says you truncate a bit later and put the mass that is in the amount of trace that's in the tail, you put it up here. So somehow these eigenvalues, they crop up. I mean, let's not talk much about this Euler equation, but these eigenvalues, they do crop up in the Euler-Lagrange equations of this mixed models in a nice way, because okay, let's see, if you had Hartree-Fock, you get a system of nonlinear PDEs for these phi i's, for these representing functions, which are exactly the eigenfunctions of this operator. So something I didn't write, but I say. So if I give you a wave function and ask you to check whether it's Hartree-Fock or not, you just compute the eigenvalues of this density matrix to answer yes or no. And if you've answered yes, it is Hartree-Fock, then you compute the eigenfunctions, and those are the phis in the Hartree-Fock. Okay, so you also give me the explicit representation back. So, and then in these mixed models, somehow, so you get a plus equation with potentials, some non-local, non-linear terms, blah, 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 which is, by the way, linking a bit to this Gross-Peter-Jevsky problem. I mean, if this repulsive interaction here was a delta function, you would get a cubic term here, and that's exactly how the cubic term in the Gross-Peter-Jevsky equation comes about, by some scaling. These eigenvalues, they appear as sort of diffusion coefficients in front of the Laplacians, and then the coupling coefficients, and this potential term stays the same as it was. So somehow the ratio between the potential term and the Laplacian changes as you go to the equations for the higher eigenfunctions of this density matrix. And so it's sort of a singular limit. I mean, a sort of epsilon, because the minimum guy has to tend to zero if you make k large, because they all have to be less than 1 and they have to sum to n. So if you make k very big, the minimum guy tends to zero. So it sort of gets singular. Okay, and there's a sort of remark, if you want, you may now want to know, so if I have a true ground state for quantum mechanics, I've drawn it like this, but how do we know it couldn't just use finitely many phi i's? So that's now a theorem which recently appeared in Proceedings Royal Society London A. This rank is really infinite for any ground state of any of these atomic or molecular problems. Unfortunately, I've been unable to determine the rate, so decay would be a nice problem. Okay, so now, I have a bit of time, let's see what I want to do with it. So some remark on the existence theory. You can also ask whether these functionals have infinitely many critical points. So for quantum mechanics, that's again classical. For Hartree-Fock, was proved by Pierre Lelion in 87, and for these mixed models was proved very recently by Mathieu Levin, who is in Paris Dauphine. using Fang Guzhou's variational principle and some nice quantum chemistry arguments. So in fact, all these models have infinitely many critical points, so sort of excited states. And then maybe in the remaining time, I think it would be fun to talk about, to go back to this problem 2 of interatomic forces. So let me put this back up here. So problem 2, understand interatomic potential. So simplest possibility, you take two hydrogen atoms and there's a sort of recent theorem joined with my graduate student Phil Gardner in Warwick, which says the following. So for H2, you only have two atoms, and let's assume they sit at zero and R times E1. So then the interatomic potential just depends on this R here, because everything is rotationally symmetric and translation invariant. So the theorem says that at long range, this V behaves like a certain positive constant minus a positive constant divided by R to the 6, so which is a sort of famous van der Waals attraction. And I should say that such an attraction can be achieved is very well known in the physics literature, and it's also easily to write it down rigorously. Elliot Leeb wrote a nice paper about this in the 80s. So simply, if you take a trial function, well, it's not a Leonard Jones, you see, because at short range it actually blows up. This is kind of trivial. At short range it goes like another constant over R, so it blows up like 1/R. So in Leonard Jones, in standard Leonard Jones, it's not quite that. So it's very well known that you can achieve this attraction by a good trial function. What's new is the lower bound. So I think Giovanni Alberti has the best way of stating this sort of phenomenon. Lack of imagination is never a proof. And maybe also I should say the power is not independent of the atom you would use. And so what I expect is the following. For different dimers, I would expect the power, like in the first two periods, I would expect the power to be 5 for boron and carbon and oxygen and fluorine, and for the other guys I expect the power 6. And I think it's not completely out of the question to prove this. I said earlier in my introduction that this attraction is not caused by a far field, but by a local change induced by the other atom. And it's now then, but also this local change is kind of a bit subtle, because what you would intuitively think is, okay, you have two lumps of charge somehow sitting there, and at long range it should be just some sort of electrostatic multipole interaction. And this power 6, the only thing that gives you power 6 is sort of a sort of quadrupole-octopole interaction. I mean, would they really sort of form a quadrupole-octopole? I mean, they kind of don't. It isn't there. It's something else. I do want to finish in time. Maybe should I say something about where this comes from? Okay, so now I guess we start. What was it? 10? Yeah, 10-2. Okay, so I say it in 2 minutes. So the right argument is somehow asymptotically, so at long range, the function approximately wants to be approximately something like so you have something like 0 here and RE1 here. So it wants approximately to be something like some sort of ground state of a non-interacting system. But if you look at the energy carefully and expand, so this would be the ground state if you switch off all the interaction terms between these two guys. And so if you carefully expand, so the energy is roughly speaking like some constant epsilon square minus epsilon over R cubed, where epsilon is sort of the distance in L2 minus this non-interacting state of like two hydrogen atoms. And so so sort of to deviate from the state, you pay an energy of amount epsilon square that comes from the non-interacting terms. You're in the local minima of those because they're minimized, but you gain some sort of local polarization, which sort of so if you do a multipole expansion of all the interactions, the first non-vanishing term is a sort of dipole-dipole interaction, and this comes with 1 over distance to the 3, and if you minimize this guy over epsilon, you find that epsilon wants to be of the order 1 over r to the 3, and then therefore this difference is of the order 1 over r to the 6. So that's how this comes. And so maybe the sort of physical picture what the wave function does, maybe I just do it by hand rather than by a picture. So if you have these two nuclei here, what you could think is that maybe one electron goes here and the other goes there to sort of create a dipole, but then they would be too polarized and would deviate too much from the quantum state. So instead, they flip between left and right, but they sort of do it in phase. So basically, each time this guy's on the left, the other guy's on the right, and vice versa, but the local charge distribution at each atom stays radially symmetric to these lowest orders. So that's sort of what these guys do. And okay, we have a formula for the correction and everything.